welcome back to the Squawker Talker. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. And joining me today for a fully jam-packed show is Greg Stobart, or Stobes, as we've come to know him. How are you doing, Stobes?
I'm very good, thanks, Greg. Very good, thanks.
You were up at the Etihad this weekend, weren't you?
Yeah, I got stuck in Manchester as well. I missed the last train home, so I had to stay overnight and forced to drink a few beers, which was a great shame, yeah.
How terrible. Well, I'm sure we'll get onto that a little bit more a little later on. And George Ellick is also here. You were at Stamford Bridge this weekend.
Yeah, it was. No beers for me.
No beers.
But it was as expected, really. It was a good game. Hull were impressive, but we'll get there.
We will.
Later on.
We will. We will come on to that shortly. But as we just said then with Mr. Stobart, Manchester City 2, Tottenham Hotspur 2. Last week on the pod, we said this is going to be the game of the weekend. And it delivered, didn't it, really?
Yeah, it did. It didn't quite deliver how we expected it to, did it, Greg? I think Manchester City were excellent. Reminded me a little bit, they got thumped by Leicester and they reacted and beat Arsenal. And it was a little bit like that. Certainly, there was a lot more focus. Tactically, Guardiola got it spot on. I think there is a blueprint to beat Tottenham at the moment, or to at least cause them problems. And it starts with pinning back the fullbacks, Danny Rose and Kyle Walker. Mourinho did it with Mkhitaryan and Martial. Guardiola did it even better with Sane and Sterling. And Spurs just couldn't beat the press. And City were all over them. And it was a 2-2 thrashing, really, wasn't it? Because City should have won the game about 5-0, and a decent result for Tottenham in the end. I mean, if you're talking about the title, they're another 2 points behind Chelsea after the weekend, but some good character and a decent point because they really should have lost.
I mean, if you were to look at their two games this season against City in a cup tie almost, they've won the tie, haven't they? They are 2-0 at home, 2-2 away. It's not a bad return, really, for a side that you look at their difference in resources. City probably should be out in front, but even though it was an impressive result for City in the end, if not the actual scoreline, but the actual performance, does this raise actually more questions about Guardiola's work? Because when the adrenaline's there, his players seem to be up for it. Aguero was chasing after defenders, closing down Lloris. We don't see that every week from them. So does that actually raise more questions about his team?
Maybe because they didn't get the result that the performance deserved. I still think that that's a massive and positive the way they came out and played against Spurs. I think that not many people saw it coming in the way they absolutely battered a team who, to be honest, Spurs are so great at stopping teams from playing, and they just couldn't stop City. In a way, the worst thing that happened to Tottenham was the goal, or both goals, because that meant they had to throw caution to the wind and they had to kind of roll the dice somewhat, and they managed to get a draw out of it. I think if City had scored later on, then that probably wouldn't have happened. And obviously, Gabriel Jesus thought he'd opened his account with, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to go, only for it to be chalked off. I think that this is probably going to be the beginning of City turning it around.
We've said this before, though, haven't we?
But it's so easy to forget how like imperious they were at the beginning of the season when they went on that winning streak. They've already been good, and they've just been in a rut recently. I think that the demeanour of their manager hasn't really helped, and I think, again, because of the penalty decision, he's still not best pleased. But, I'd expect this to be a bit of a watershed moment. Similarly, as the loss to Spurs was earlier in the season, which kind of undid them, maybe this will be what ties them back together.
There's been a weird sense of that, almost like fatalism around Guardiola the last few weeks, where some people even said he'd given up on trying to change English football and he was trying to play a more basic 4-2-3-1 and just let the players get on with it. Whereas he lined up with a 4-1-4-1 against Spurs. Look at the team sheet beforehand, people were almost mocking him ahead of the game, going, "You're going to sit Yaya Toure against Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen. He's going to be overrun." But it was a masterstroke, wasn't it, Stobes?
Yeah, well, and it's the formation they played at the start of the season when they were so good as well, freeing up Silva and De Bruyne. I thought De Bruyne was absolutely brilliant. They played a little bit more direct as well than in recent weeks. It's been quite slow and ponderous, certainly, when I watched the Everton game. But, you know, De Bruyne was getting the ball and he was putting it in behind, turning Tottenham around. They hated it. I'm not entirely sure I agree with George just because of that back four and the goalkeeper. You've got Fernandinho to come back soon enough, but it didn't really matter. It was generally attack is the best form of defence for City, and, you know, very few teams could cope with City if they're playing with that kind of quality. And it's the speed as well, really, for me. They've been quite slow and clunky, and they found it difficult trying to break down teams that put 10 men behind the ball, and they slow it down and slow it down. But everything was at 100 miles an hour at the weekend. It worked perfectly.
But is it a testament to Spurs that we're seeing this 2-0 draw with Spurs at home for City at the Etihad as a great result for City?
I think people are seeing that if they didn't watch the game. I think if you watch the game, then I'm pretty sure that wouldn't have felt like a good result back in the changing room when they're 2-0 up. They've absolutely battered them. I'm sure that, you know, if you didn't see it and you checked the score afterwards, you'd be like, "Ah, oh, fair enough, but they didn't get beat, which is okay." But actually, on the balance of play, they deserve to win the game, and they'll be gutted that they didn't. I mean, a word on Bravo, just because obviously he's had a terrible, terrible season. He doesn't look like a capable keeper at all, but this run isn't going to continue. You know, he's firstly this thing about where he's had conceded six shots on target and they've all been goals. Like, the quality of finishing has been absolutely superb. He hasn't really, except for Lookman's one through his legs, which actually, we know that when a ball gets hard, hit hard from close range to a keeper's legs, there's not much they can do. He didn't have a chance with it. Should he have come? Probably not for Ali's goal. And Son's goal was a fantastic finish as well. You can't blame him there.
But can you blame Lloris? I mean, people were saying his two mistakes that in some ways handed City the lead. Okay, City were good, but Lloris, especially the header when he came off his line, was pretty poor. But would Spurs have even been in it if he wasn't on the field? Because he made some superb saves besides those mistakes. So.
Yeah, in the first half, there were a couple where, I mean, the problem with Bravo isn't, you know, he couldn't do anything about the goal. The problem is he does let in quite a lot of savable shots. Mm. You think back to when Chelsea beat him, for example, the Willian one, you know, a better goalkeeper would save those.
Yeah.
Lloris was saving those in the first half, certainly kept out Aguero a couple of times. But, you know, it's quite funny, actually, that the two goals Tottenham should have conceded five or six, but the two they did concede were absolute gifts. You know, it's nothing to do with City's finishing. It was horrible mistakes from Lloris, very uncharacteristic. But yeah, I think Pochettino said that. I was in the press conference after the game. He said, you know, he makes one or two, every goalkeeper makes mistakes, he makes one or two a game, and we would have been out of sight if he hadn't played so well in the first half. But certainly he was very disappointed. I know he spoke to some journalists in the Mix Zone. He was very disappointed with his own performance, and he thanked the team for getting him out of trouble.
I mean, I think that the second one was obviously a massive, massive clanger. I mean, not only to drop it, but to drop it into the path of someone like Haliburton, who's obviously going to tuck it away. Interestingly, David Priest on Twitter was talking about the first one, and he was saying that actually he thinks Lloris did the right thing. He should have come out. He had to come and attack the ball, and that effectively he almost didn't commit to the header well enough. You know, as a keeper, you're not really used to that situation of running full pelt and trying to do a diving header next to someone's midriff.
I think he said he threw himself at the ball rather than where the ball was going
to
be.
Exactly, or try to put his head on the ball rather than through the ball.
Yeah,
which is an interesting take on it. Again, 9 times out of 10, that probably ricochets off Sané's arm or his chest and goes elsewhere. It was just lucky it fell to him for an easy finish.
Mm. Well, talking of things going on in the upper body area, Kyle Walker was a focus of some contention. We talk about City, maybe felt they should have won it. Never mind Gabriel Jesus' disallowed goal. Raheem Sterling was through on goal, and he was pushed over by Kyle Walker, wasn't he, Stokes? What did you make of that? Was it cynicism, or was it...
I mean, just live, it's just a blatant penalty, wasn't it? I mean, I think, yeah, you can call it cynical. It's just Walker.
The cynicism of champions?
Yeah, I think you said pushed over. He wasn't pushed over, he was just pushed.
Yeah.
The problem was he didn't exactly, fall over, wasn't it? I mean, you could see it clearly affected what he was doing. He was stumbling over and sort of toe-poked it straight at Hugo Lloris. He should have gone down. It would have been a penalty. Walker probably would have been sent off because it was cynical, and that would have been the game put to bed. And a lot said about Raheem Sterling, but his honesty cost City badly there.
Well, Yaya Toure said a more experienced player would have gone down and got the decision. And we've had a question through from Carl Anker off Twitter, who asks, after almost every disappointment at international level, we're always told by certain pundits that England are too honest. Sterling's obviously an England player. Should gamesmanship of that kind be taught in English football more?
We're not too honest at all. I think that's an absolute myth. I've seen plenty of English players dive, be dishonest. I mean, I don't think that's true at all.
Just to be fair to Carl, I did add the England bit myself. Bit of context.
I mean, you know, I've seen Sterling dive. I've seen Michael Owen dive. I've seen Steven Gerrard dive. I've seen Wayne Rooney dive.
So why didn't Sterling go down this time?
It was a naivety. I think he just wanted to score, and he was just so focused on scoring, you know, that he was in that moment, and he didn't really think to do it. He didn't have time. It was so instinctive. He just wanted to get his toe on the ball.
Also, there's a massive difference between diving and falling over once he's been pushed. It's not, he wouldn't be diving. He'd be maybe making the most of a challenge. But that works in two ways. Firstly, referees shouldn't have to require a player to fall over in order to give a foul, because that is encouraging diving in the future.
Mm.
And secondly, my pet hate basically in football is when you're at a game and someone goes down and the fan screams like, give him a yellow if it's not a foul. Yeah, yeah. There's a possibility.
Or his handball is ever a block.
Yeah. I mean, there's a possibility that you can fall over in a challenge and not be a dive and not be a foul as well. So.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with feeling contact and winning a penalty. You were at Arsenal Burnley. Mm. I mean, was it... who was it who went down?
Barnes.
Yeah, it was Ashley Barnes. I mean, that wasn't a trip. He wouldn't have fallen over, but he felt the contact and he went over and he got kicked in the leg, and it's a penalty and a foul.
If you want to talk about wildly experienced Premier League players, Joey Barton is up there, isn't he, really? But that nicely brings on to another question we've had from two people. Actually, quite a popular request to talk about. Written off Man United and Lord Baruda on Twitter, and what it does to talk about the standard of refereeing in the Premier League at the moment. I mean, not a weekend goes... I mean, I personally have a lot of sympathy for referees. It's a difficult job. and the game's only getting quicker and it's harder for them to keep up. But it does seem at the moment, every weekend or every other weekend even, referee decisions are being a real point of contention either in the match, post-match analysis and even during games. You see on Twitter, pretty much every single decision, someone's got something to say on it. Is the standard going down or is the scrutiny getting higher or is it a bit of both, Stoke?
I think it's a bit of both, Greg. I mean, it's a lot of the time it seems to be in the big games or with the big clubs, which doesn't help at all. You know, you think about this weekend, there's the Sterling one, there was the Koscielny offside, the Hull non-penalty award as well. So it's happening a lot of the time for the big clubs as well, which is obviously always a bit more difficult. And with the technology debate in the background, I think we can just put this to bed by bringing in some sort of technology because it is affecting games and it seems to be happening at key moments as well. If you think yesterday, even just, you know, the Arsenal one, it's in the last minute. The Chelsea one, it's at 1-0 and it's affecting the matches. And obviously the City one's at 2-1 and Spurs scored 60 seconds later.
And Mike Dean's now been demoted from Premier League duty.
For a game.
Yeah. Well, he might not be coming up because he made a pretty big clangor in his Championship
game.
I
think that people kind of don't know how lucky we are in a way. I think anyone who thinks, firstly, you say like, why in England is it so bad? We don't know about the drama that goes on the continent. We don't hear about the referee decisions out there. And also, I implore anyone to watch a kind of a La Liga game. And if you want to swap our refs for them, then you're crazy because, you know, the whistle goes every 30 seconds. You're getting kind of seven players on a booking
Pep Guardiola might prefer it though.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. But then, you know, as a spectacle, it's far better that we've got referees who are happy to let the game run. Sometimes that means that you may not get the decision that you deserve. And it's obviously very frustrating as a fan, but at the end of the day, it does even itself out. There will be times this season where City will get the rub of the green. So it's frustrating, but I wouldn't swap our refs for anyone else's.
We're going to get onto it a bit later, but it was interesting in his post-match press conference, Sean Dyche pretty much struck a very similar tone. He said that these things, you know, it's unfortunate, we deserve something out of this game, but referees have a hard job and maybe, you know, the linesman was pressurised by the pressure of the referee with the different calls of offside. If he called offside rather than let the advantage happen, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And he was very, he seemed almost like philosophical about it. But I do wonder if we took the pressure off referees, maybe they would feel a little bit, I don't know, if you put someone in an anxious situation, they tend to make more mistakes, don't they?
I don't know how we'd do that. It's a very tribal game in England. And we have a culture where sadly the fans seem to enjoy berating the referee more than they do support their team. And as long as that continues, there's always going to be a hostile atmosphere and they're going to have thick skin. I mean, that's just the way it goes.
But going down further the pyramid, I mean, there's this talk, there's going to be a huge strike from referees further down the game. Because the state of play lower down is so severe that they literally can't do their jobs. I mean, we're talking about amateur football, Sunday league, park football, all this kind of stuff, where referees just kind of do it for the love of the game. These aren't professional guys earning more. It's David Cameron who was it last year? Was it Riley? I can't remember. But a referee last year made more money than David Cameron all over the Daily Mail. But yeah, is the problem that the scrutiny at the top is actually creating quite a toxic atmosphere at the bottom? Do you think, Stopes?
Potentially. I mean, my Sunday league days are quite far behind me. So
not through suspensions, though.
No, injuries. Dodgy knees. Like most journalists, I would have been a professional if I didn't have some dodgy knees. So.
I wouldn't. But I think that it's really bad. I think that there's this weird culture here. And you see it kind of going down through the levels. I've played in like five-a-side games before where you see these prima donnas who think that they're, you know, I think they're a Premier League player shouting at these refs who are volunteering and giving their time away to officiate a game. It's a sad state of affairs.
But how do we fix this? Is it technology?
One way of fixing it is to go harder on dissent, for example, which they have been doing this year, the referees. Certainly in the first couple of months of the season, there were loads of bookings for dissent.
But then the consistency is just gone.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
Now they've demoted Mike Dean. That firebrand taking it to the players has disappeared from the.
It just frustrates me that no one's there to answer for it. No one's there. You know, the fact that Mike Dean was the only person still implementing the rules, and that's led to him. Well, I know that's not what's led to him, but he's now the person who was sent to the Championship. It just seems so inconsistent. I just think that there should be, a consistent ruling on stuff like pushing the box and dissent, which we just don't get.
Just before we move away from Manchester City versus Tottenham, obviously Vertonghen's out for Spurs with quite a nasty injury. Alderweireld said he came off because he felt his hamstring getting tight and he didn't want it to snap and lose 6 or 7 weeks of the season. I mean, if they lost both of them, where would Spurs be at, Stopes?
I mean, I think we saw how important Jan Vertonghen's been. He's been their best defender this season, and without him, Kevin Vimmer just wasn't mobile enough. He got hauled off at half-time. Even Alderweireld and Dyer, you feel there's something a little bit missing there. I think Alderweireld will be out for a couple of weeks. Spurs should be able to get through it. I think they've got Wickham, Sunderland and Middlesbrough as their next three games. So if he's back in time for tougher tests to come like Liverpool, I think Spurs will be okay. But certainly Spurs came into the game with the best defensive record in the Premier League. I think they're behind Chelsea after the weekend now. But it didn't look like it at all.
Especially from open play as well. Yeah. I mean, lots of the goals they've conceded this season have been from set pieces. And obviously the two that came against City were both from open play. I predict that we'll probably see Carter Vickers coming in and making a name for himself, because when I've seen him in the Cup, he's looked like absolutely brilliant. And is he 18 years old?
Yeah,
and he
19,
looks like a really, really polished player already.
I saw him when he played against Villa all over Abongwa Hall. He made Abongwa Hall look like the young man trying to make a play in the game. He just absolutely dominated him.
I think these days most people are all over Gabby, the fastest man who's now really slow.
There is that. There is that. Speaking of fast things getting slower, Liverpool's title charge. It seems to be, it's probably a bit dramatic to say grinding to a halt, but this was a big loss at home against Swansea City, wasn't it, Stobes?
It's been a bad month or so for Liverpool. And I mean, it started off with the performances going and now the results are going as well. And to lose, Swansea have been awful. You know, Swansea and Hull have been, and Sunderland's been the three worst teams very comfortably this season. Before the game, he wouldn't have given Swansea a hope, but you know, little Tommy Carroll doing his thing. Absolutely bossed it. I mean,
him and Olsen down the left were just having a great time, weren't they?
I mean, I think Liverpool fans were hoping, you know, Coutinho would come back and then they'd just click into the fifth gear, which they were in September, October, November. The Matip situation, I don't think, helps at all, especially the way they've been defending at times in his absence. But certainly, there's just not that fluidity. The movement, and it's always a worry with a Jurgen Klopp side, I guess, that especially, you know, I don't think it's coincidence that it's come during and after the busy Christmas period for Liverpool. And you know, they work so hard, he pushes them so hard, they picked up a few key injuries, Henderson was out for a little bit as well, and I think that's why it's costing them. And maybe they'll get their act together, maybe it'll settle down a bit, and in late February, March they'll get going again. But at the moment, I just feel they look a little bit tired, a little bit leggy. The injuries aren't helping. They've lost their fluency.
Mm. Our chief content officer, Amar Singh, tweeted during the game that if Jurgen Klopp plays heavy metal football, then Liverpool are looking a bit like Spinal Tap, really. I mean, how big a loss is Sadio Mane? Because to my eyes, he's the man that makes them click, basically. His pace and directness is...
I think he's a huge loss, and Senegal look like they're now the kind of tournament favourite, so he's probably going to be gone for the duration of the AFCON. But it's not that didn't really surprise me that much, because Liverpool have been really bad against bad teams all season. They can't break down teams who set up to defend. We've seen them struggle. I mean, even obviously they lost 2-0 to Burnley. They drew 2-0 with Sunderland. They drew 0-0 at home to Plymouth in the FA Cup. Like, this is a symptomatic part of their play. They can't break down teams who play two banks of four, who sit back, and they can't get through them. The likes of Coutinho and Firmino obviously are prone to a pot shot, and so they shoot quite a lot.
This sounds worryingly Brendan Rodgers-esque.
Well, it's just, I just didn't find it, you know, that...
I know it's become a cliche to make those comparisons, but that is literally the same problem they had
But there seems to be almost like an arrogance where there's still, Liverpool fans don't seem to have grasped that yet. Like, they don't seem to see. And also, it was absolutely unbelievable that Klopp pushed Lallana into that front three. His form for Liverpool this season has been absolutely unbelievable. And obviously, they're missing Mane anyway, but he's been playing in that three so successfully. All the goals he scored this season have been when he's started in that position. So to push him forward was almost a bit arrogant, as if like it doesn't really matter how good he's been there. We're much better than these guys that we can just play him out of position. What is now out of position and expect to still pull through.
But one player that was playing his position, some people were surprised by this, but a transfer target apparently for Chelsea and Antonio Conte, used to play under him at Juventus. Fernando Llorente, he was fantastic. He scored two goals. The second one especially was... The header was superb, wasn't it, Stobes?
Two great headers, but the second goal, it was goal of the day, really, for me. Just Tom Carroll's cross, you won't see a better one. Whipped it in, he's attacked the ball. I mean, he's rolling back the years a bit, Llorente. That wasn't even the event, that was the Bilbao Llorente, wasn't it? Just absolutely monstrous.
Spurs target Llorente for
Tom Carroll was Tom Carroll being the English Icemoonian there.
So, it was a brilliant goal. Maybe another goalkeeper might have got there, I don't know. It was close range, and he's got so much power and the run on it. But Swansea were full value, like we mentioned. Tom Carroll earlier, genuinely, he controlled the game really with it was quick passing and getting in between the lines. And that was defensively, Liverpool just didn't really seem to have an answer. And you know, a couple of crosses, a bit of luck for the winner. But I think Swansea deserved it. And you know, full credit to Paul Clement as well, because, you know, we're going to talk about Hull later, but both of them changed manager and they look like they might have changed very quickly their performances.
Well, one of the big things we talked about this season is Swansea lacking an identity. And Tom Carroll's a Swansea player through and through. He's great on the ball. He's not the biggest guy in the world. He's much more about intelligence and technique than anything else. I mean, looking at him, and especially with Olsen, they had a great combination down the left. Two new signings for Swansea under Clement. Do you think he can turn it around?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that the good thing about that Carroll signing is it showed Swansea fans immediately that they're not going to tear up the blueprint. The Palace are still getting good footballers playing decent football. And if you look at the players they've got in their team, the likes of now Carroll, Sigurdsson, Key, like these are all proper footballers. Llorente, like they're all really good players on the ball. And I think where they've struggled is A, with their belief this season, and B, their defence has been A, poor, and B, they've never been able to play a consistent back four. And if Clement can sort that out and they can build from the back like they used to do, control possession from deep, then I think that they'll be absolutely fine. And, you know, it's so tight at the bottom. It literally just takes two or three wins and they'll be not even... They won't be safe. They'll just be clear of it.
Yeah, look at West Ham. West Ham are 10th now.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as we'll come on to a bit later on, there's a few teams hovering over that drop zone that might be in a bit of trouble. But moving on now to Arsenal versus Burnley. Arsenal are now up to second after that win. Won through a very, very late penalty, I believe, in the 96th minute after Burnley got their equaliser in the 94th minute through that penalty we were talking about earlier with Joey Barton getting kicked by Coquelin. Xhaka also got sent off, and Wenger got sent to the stand as well for pushing over. Giving a push to Anthony Taylor, the fourth official. Absolute chaos. I mean, this is an extremely misleading league position for Arsenal, isn't it, George?
Yeah, it is. I mean, their performances don't live up to being second in the league. At the same time, how misleading can it be? Even if they do drop down in the future, you still got to say they're second there by right at the moment. And you look at the teams around them, except for Chelsea, and does anyone deserve to be second? Spurs, probably, but except for that, no team can be particularly happy with their performances currently. Again, like if Xhaka doesn't get that red card, it's probably going to be a pretty comfortable victory as well. It was a shame. I mean, Burnley, such a shame for them not to hold on. I think with the Wenger, stuff, it looked to me like he was just trying to push him because he wanted to watch the game.
and
he was just in his way. So I think he's probably going to get a massive ban for it.
Yeah, there's course for like six games and a huge fine.
He's got previous as well. And you can assume that some choice words were probably said, which is foul and abusive, and then he's going to push him. So you'd guess it's not going to be great for them. But again, Arsenal for how many years now have impressed, have been easy on the eye, and yet have struggled to get into second. So maybe for once they're not playing too well. They're struggling in midfield, but actually they're picking up the points to put them the best of the rest.
We had another question off Twitter. Ahmed Youssef asks, are Arsenal's late goals, obviously another late one in the 97th minute, a sign of resilience, or do you think they're a symptom of poor games management? If they could manage games better, would they need to do these big comebacks at the end?
No, but I think there has been a little bit of a mentality shift. I don't think they would have won these games a couple of years ago or got these points. You know, they've done it twice just against Burnley this season. I mean, I'm sure they'd rather be cruising past Burnley and then winning in the last minute against Tottenham, Man City and Chelsea. But, you know, I think there has been a change. You know, you look at the Bournemouth game, it was classic Arsenal really being 3-0 down in the first place, but they wouldn't have come back. They wouldn't have come back a couple of years ago. And that's why they're second, essentially, as well. You know, it's those late goals, that spirit. Without playing well, they managed to grind it out. And
maybe if it wasn't Arsenal, we'd be saying this is the hallmark of champions.
If it was Fergie's Man United, we absolutely would. I mean, they didn't play, you know, Fergie's Man United not wipe the floor with teams every single week. They had to grind out a lot of 1-0s like Chelsea have this season. They had to win a lot of games in the last minute. You're not going to play amazingly well for 38 games. The problem for Arsenal is if they are in the title challenge, it's when it comes to February, March. Will they be playing well, or will they be able to score these last minute winners and grind out these results then? And it's very hard to have any faith in them to do that.
Speaking of perceptions, I mean, that's one thing Arsenal fans are saying about Granit Xhaka's red card. If it wasn't Granit Xhaka putting that tackle, he wouldn't have been sent off. It was all based on his past reputation. John Moss is obviously the guy who sent him off in his last straight red in the Premier League. I'm not so sure about that theory myself. I mean, I was at the game and it did look...
It looked a red card.
It did.
You know, first look was a red card. I mean, it wasn't an absolute disgusting knee-high challenge, but it was absolutely idiotic.
It's the way he tackles. We've seen it with a lot of players in the past. You know, tackling is a technique, and his technique seems to be to jump with 2 feet off the floor.
Well, Wenger said in his press conference, we've been telling him not to slide in, to stay on your feet. And he's clearly not listening. And as we say, I think he's been sent off 5 times since the start of last season across all Europe's top 5 leagues, more than anyone else. So this isn't John Moss having it in for a player. This is clearly a part of his game. But how big a loss will this be for Arsenal, Stokes? Because all is out injured for who knows. Elneny's at the African Combination of Egypt, who are a good side, and he could be there for quite some time as well. What are they going to do in midfield?
I've got to say, I think Xhaka has been pretty average so far this season for a £35 million player.
But there's nobody else.
I think he'll probably do Coquelin and Ramsey maybe. The problem with Ramsey is his discipline when he plays centrally. He just goes walkabout and you can get exposed defensively. But I think Arsenal will be able to get by without him. They've got Chelsea coming up and he's going to miss the Chelsea game. Yeah, that'll be the
four
big
games he's going to be out
that'll
for.
Be the big test really, because in that kind of game, that's when you probably would go for Coquelin and Xhaka and sit in a bit, especially with Hazard and Pedro playing where they do. But really, I think Arsenal will be okay without him. I don't think there's too much between a lot of these players. The one they're really missing still is Santi Cazorla, and he's not going to be back for a while.
But I mean, moving on from Cazorla is basically the big problem with Arsenal, because you can't rely on a guy with information problems as severe as his. And I mean, before he got sent off, maybe there were signs. Arsenal didn't really get out of first gear, really, but there were signs maybe with this 4-1-4-1 shape, a little bit similar to what City did actually against Spurs, with Xhaka dropping back to almost play the Yaya Toure role. That freed Ramsey up to get forward next to Mesut Ozil, who was actually very, very good, I thought. He was back to his kind of, he got an assist, but he didn't look like the playmaker. He looked like this free roaming midfielder again, trying to get in the box and make things happen. He had a couple of good chances. But is that maybe a template they can come back to when Xhaka's available, or in another more controlling holding midfielders available? Because I think Coquelin in that role is just going to be flying around everywhere, losing his position.
A bit of a headless chicken, isn't he?
I think maybe people misjudge the kind of player that Xhaka is. Obviously, he is a very tidy passer, if not particularly creative. But I still think that him and Coquelin can't play together in the midfield too. They're just too similar. And Xhaka is the one that's wasted, because obviously if you are going to do that, then it will be Coquelin sitting in the defensive role and Xhaka further forward. I think we've seen probably Xhaka's best performances this season when he's been playing alongside Elneny. The Palace game on New Year's Day was a good example of that, because that enables him to be that person sitting with Elneny, the runner in front. I do think that's a kind of a decent blueprint. I think that he is going to be important to them. I couldn't agree more with Stobes that obviously for £35 million, he hasn't looked nearly good enough for that. But at the same time, it's too early to write him off. He's a young enough for that position as well to have a big future there, and they should almost start building a team around him and where his strengths lie, as opposed to kind of trying to shoehorn him into another system. So it's good to see Arsene for once changing his ways.
Absolutely. I mean, we got a question off Twitter which maybe ties into this from Zavjev asks off Twitter, which Arsenal midfielder is now the most important at the club? I mean, it's still Cazorla.
It's been Cazorla.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's Cazorla, definitely, but I'd say it's Xhaka in his absence, without a doubt.
They just need to wean their dependency off him. Before we move on, just a quick word on Burnley. Sean Dyche. Can we have a word of appreciation for Sean Dyche? I mean, he keeps going to these grounds in the top six. He's only got 1 point from all his away games so far this season, away at Old Trafford. But, I mean, they were impressive against City at the Etihad. They were impressive against Arsenal as well, actually. And he felt very hard done by. Is he a bit underappreciated, a bit underrated?
A little bit. Certainly when, you look at that Burnley starting 11 yesterday, and only two or three, you'd say, were Premier League footballers even, really. You know, it was a load of Championship footballers, wasn't it?
One guy who couldn't make it at Rangers as well.
Yeah. He actually did all right when he came on, I thought. But I mean, yeah, and, they played to their strength. I thought Michael Keane was really good yet again yesterday. You know, they're never going to go and outplay Arsenal away. They get absolutely thrashed. And it's just a little bit of composure on the ball, really, in the final third. They had a couple of chances in the first half in particular to counter-attack. Maybe just a little bit of a bad touch from Gray, or a little bit of lack of composure, wrong decision. That's what's costing them, really.
It's like they don't spot that other run. That's
But I think the great thing about Dyche is that he's been afforded what most managers pray for in their careers, is he's been given time to build exactly what he wants at Burnley. He's had, five seasons there now. When they got relegated, they stuck by him, and he was able to bring them back up again. This is his team. Like, I mean, they've been hired to play the way he wants to play. They're the players that he would have wanted to bring in. And therefore, I think you'd want to be careful if you were hiring him for a bigger club, because obviously he probably wouldn't have that time, wouldn't have the same players he can call upon.
Inevitably, he was like, oh, could Sean Dyche be the man to succeed Arsene Wenger in the previews to this game at the weekend?
I mean, that's
just Moyes, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Not to dismiss Dyche.
I'd say like the England job would probably be more fitting, because then he can actually implement his style of play. But just a word on Tom Heaton, because he's been, whilst Michael Keane is great and probably got a huge future because of his age, Heaton's been one of the best keepers in the league this season. Without him, they would struggle. He was very good again, although I think he did make the mistake for not clearing the ball before the penalty. But he's a class act, and they're really lucky to have him. And being a team like that, being able to have a really good, solid keeper that you can depend upon is huge.
Well, you were at the game, Greg. I thought you know, what, as soon as Vokes came on and started winning those headers, you could feel the equaliser coming, yeah, actually. You know, against, yeah, 10 men, that last 5-10 minutes, every long ball, Vokes was knocking it down, and there was an almighty scramble in the box. Barnes had a chance as well. So, you know, I think...
Well, moving on now to Stoke City versus Man United, 1-1 at the Britannia. Were Man United lucky again? Will Mourinho be bringing that line back out into the press? Looking at the stats, they're actually lowest in the league for converting what Opta called the big chances, the chances that you should reasonably expect the player to score, either because they're close range or they're just, you know, they're free to take a shot. Only 34.43% of those chances have been converted by Man United. What's going on, George?
It's so hard to say, really, because, I mean, if you think Zlatan Ibrahimovic is probably the person you'd want the most to put where your big chances away, it's hard to really come up with a reason. I think that they've got a problem where they often go behind in games, and that tells a story itself where Jose is probably a bit biased, because obviously it's natural when you go 1-0 up that the opposition team are going to sit back, which in turn naturally means you're going to have more possession, you're going to create more chances, but the quality of the chances may not be as good. Mm. And so therefore, you know, if a ball comes into the box and someone has a header and there are 8 people in the box instead of 4, then obviously that's going to be a tougher chance to score from. So they've got to start. And they had started, you know, scoring the first goals in games. And obviously this was another occasion where they conceded first and spent the rest of the game on the front foot. Again, it's hard to... generally, with trends like this, it'll even itself out, so you can probably expect them to start scoring more often, especially when there's no tangible reason for these misses.
I mean, we're not far off the end of the season, though. I mean, this has been a problem.
Yeah, but it's not season by season. You know, it could be in a year's time when suddenly we're talking about how they've got the best shot conversion rate, and it doesn't work in blocks like that. If we were seeing a certain player consistently missing chances, then there'd be more of an issue. But at the moment, I think, you know, so long as they keep creating chances, they... Again, got to take the initiative in games more, but I wouldn't be too concerned it should turn itself around.
I mean, it sounds a little bit like when Kenny Dalglish came back to Liverpool, and I think they topped the charts for hitting the woodwork and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. They were creating loads of chances, but just weren't putting them away. Is there any sense of it's the style of play? I mean, Man United have gone from being very kind of cautious and low shots under Louis van Gaal, but actually in some ways quite clinical in how they use those opportunities, whereas now they're almost like playing with opulence. You've got Mkhitaryan running off, doing all these kind of crazy things. And they just, it's all about like free improv, basically. Do you think there's any element that if they were a bit more boring, they might be a bit more efficient?
I don't know. I mean, you look at the weekend, that one matter chance. I mean, how can you legislate for... And he scores goals as well. And how can you legislate for him missing a practically open goal from inside the 6-yard box? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's just been that kind of season for United. You thought they'd probably got over these kind of results from that they were having in September and October. It's very similar to, you know, the last Stoke game and Burnley and all those other games when they were...
Mourinho has blamed Van Gaal's brainwashing in the past, so maybe there's a mental block.
But I mean, Mata didn't try and take a touch before he shot, did he? So...
maybe he should have done. Maybe he should have kept the Van Gaal heritage going on. But one player that did find the back of the net was obviously Wayne Rooney. He salvaged a point and he got his record. What an achievement.
Oh, finally, and it was goal worthy.
What a goal.
Yeah,
it was. What a free kick.
I mean, I can't believe some people were saying that he didn't mean it. He
I didn't know that.
I saw some people on Twitter saying, you know, it was an overhit cross.
People always find a way of dismissing
him. He knew exactly what he was doing.
I'm someone who struggles to really appreciate free kicks unless they're scored by David Beckham. And that was a proper...
And Rooney does not have that haircut.
No, he doesn't. But that was a proper, like, really... top-notch free kick, like from that angle to get the dip. I mean, the keeper had absolutely no chance, and it's quite rare, I think, that you can say that a keeper has no chance for a free kick. So well done, Wayne. Really,
you talk about clutch players, and even if his general game has gone to hell of late, which may be a bit overstated as well, but he is there in the moments more often than not, isn't he? Even if it's at the penalty spot.
Yeah, he's still around, and you know his role's changed this season. He's a substitute. He's playing in the cups, but actually, if you look at his output this season, I still think doing a job for United. It's not the job he used to do. It's not the job you expect from the captain and, you know, the number 10 and the guy who's earning £300,000 a week. But certainly he's been useful for United. I think certainly at the start of the season, I think some of the criticism was a little bit over the top and we kind of blinded by the other stuff.
There's almost an anger every time he did something useful. Yeah. Well, he's not being the team now.
Ooh. It's partly because, you know, Mkhitaryan wasn't playing and, you know, they signed all these players and Pogba wasn't playing well at the time and it was frustrating that the team seemed to be built around Rooney playing badly, but certainly still got a role to play and he showed that yet again.
Stoke, though, they're a team very much in form now, but there's a sense that Mark Hughes is like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. This case is happening every year. They have a terrible, terrible start. They go on a great run. Is there any chance that a sign like Saido Berahino, a player that they've courted in the past and finally signed from West Brom after a very protracted transfer battle over many, many, many transfer windows. Is that the kind of signing that can now take him to the top? Wilfred Bonny hasn't really worked, has it?
I don't think that is necessarily a signing that I'd be too excited about. He's hardly played any football for 18 months. And they're not really having any problem scoring goals. They've got a wealth of attacking talent. I personally would have like Marko Arnautović as a far better, I know they're slightly different positions, but far, far kind of higher calibre player than Berahino. And Berahino's obviously got some issues with his attitudes. I know that obviously he wanted to leave, it's not great, but he's been there for so long now, basically rotting in the reserves. And West Brom have been pretty happy without him. They haven't really had to call upon him at all. The issue is with Stoke is that what's the end game? I think we're beyond now a Premier League where teams like Stoke can muscle their way into a shock. Or I mean, obviously Leicester won the league last year, but you know, consistent European football. And Mark Hughes is maybe somewhat tainted goods in terms of big clubs. I think because of the way that ended at City, where he didn't actually do too bad a job, but. You've got to hope for him that he's going to get a chance to prove himself again at a bigger club, because I think he's done a really good job there and he's shown he can manage big players as well.
Well, just one last word on United. Are they pretty much stuck with sixth place now?
Yeah, it feels like that, doesn't it? I mean, it was an opportunity this weekend.
It's quite a gap
with Liverpool between with Liverpool losing and with City and Tottenham drawing, it was a chance to close the gap, wasn't it? And I think they're more consistent than Man City, potentially even better than Arsenal, but the gap's not shrinking. That's the problem. And even after that run of wins, it's still not shrunk. But there's so long to go. A couple of results. They still got to play a lot of teams around them. A couple of swings and results, and it can all change. But at the moment, they're just a little bit short.
And the one thing to remember with them is that they've got the joy of not really having any pressure upon them. We saw last season how Arsenal in the last minute kind of skipped above Spurs, because obviously Spurs were playing high pressure games, whereas Arsenal were picking up points for fun, because to be fair, they were going to come third and then suddenly they come second. So whilst towards the back end of the season, if United are actually kind of around fifth and sixth and they can pick up points without really feeling the pressure, and the teams above them have got to pick them up, then we might see them sneak a couple of places high, because they're definitely good enough to do it.
Well, speaking of gaps, pressure games and all the rest of it, Chelsea, they've got even more daylight between themselves and the rest after beating Hull City 2-0 in a game that was probably harder to win than maybe the form book of the two teams would suggest, George.
Yeah, I was there and I was really impressed with Hull. I think that every time you see a Hull play under Marco Silva, every time you hear him talk, he just becomes more and more impressive. They look really lucky to have him. He looks like a proper, he's intelligent. He's got them playing really good football. Evandro, who he brought in from Porto, who was with him at Estoril, that's a really tidy player yesterday.
Where are Merson Tomo now, eh?
I'd love to know. I'd absolutely love to know. I mean, but the interesting thing with tactically, he played a formation yesterday where he kind of played Hernandez up front with kind of Klukas and Evandro sitting just behind. So almost like a front three, which is a very, and three at the back as well, which is an interesting way to play against Chelsea, because it effectively meant that went in the kind of times where they had possession of the ball, which was a lot. I think they outpassed Chelsea in the game. They shifted in a way that all three centre-backs were kind of taken up in effect, and you had the likes of Harry Maguire, who was playing the kind of right side of a defensive three, marauding forward at absolute free will on the ball, because there was so much space because the defence was taken up. And I think that kind of tactical flexibility and ingenuity will put them in good stead. Again, like Swansea, it doesn't take much to pick up points, and having been there yesterday, I really hope the Hull and Marco Silva are successful, because they're doing it the right way and it's good to watch, and they're very impressive.
I think we said a few weeks back on the pod that he's probably the first correct decision they've made in months, really, appointing him.
I'm glad it's looking like we're down there on our faces.
I won't mention all the bad calls we've made
over
the weeks.
No, I completely agree. I mean, in his presser yesterday, he just seemed like a bright football guy. And his pedigree, as we've said before, is just really, really, really good. He's the kind of person who actually, if someone had gone to a bigger club in the Premier League, probably everyone would have got a bit more excited and looked a bit more at what he'd done in the past. So, thumbs up for them. But yeah, Chelsea deserved their win. And just Hazard, first half was just absolutely brilliant again. He played much more centrally than he had been in recent weeks, maybe because they're playing that back three. And he just completely ran the show. And when he's on that kind of form, there's no one I'd rather watch.
I mean, on the point of pedigree, Diego Costa back in the team, seemingly happy as Larry. Fabregas comes off the bench, creates another assist. They've just got the match winners. There's no real stopping them, is there?
No, probably not. I don't think. Costa was He wasn't great. He got a lot of goal scoring opportunities. And as I said, Fabregas is just every time he plays, I just wish there was a way he could start every week, because it's such a waste of talent having that guy sitting on the bench, because his passing ability is absolutely phenomenal.
Mm, but maybe that sums up why Chelsea are so good, that they can keep a player on the bench and use them as and when they need. They're now among the top four teams to have taken the most points from 22 games with 55 points. When does Antonio Conte start looking ahead of this season, thinking, I really am creating like a foundation here to do something more than just win one title? I could probably maybe even do what I did at Juve, but in England.
I think he's already done that. I think, actually, if you look at their January transfer business, you can see that, because a couple of months ago, he would have thought, I need at least one or two centre-backs, maybe another central midfielder, just for this season to get through to, whether it's to win the league or finish in the top four. And they've kind of shelved those plans. I mean, he still said he would, if he could, he'd get one, but he shelved the plans because rather than buy a B option, the second option, recall Nathan Aké, and in the summer, let's get some real top quality to beef up what's already a very strong squad. You know, they brought on Fabregas, Willian and Batshuayi yesterday. You know, that's about £100 million worth of players, and they're all very, very good as well.
And also the players that they're being linked with, the likes of Frank Kessié and Tomi Bakayoko, who are all in their early 20s, which would suggest that he's very happy to bring in players for the future rather than players who are going to come in and be quick fixes.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they're not going to sign another Cuadrado. They're going to go
That's exactly it. That's the warning sign, isn't it? Why spend 30 million on a player just for the sake of it when Chelsea should win the league now? I mean, you know, they've got Liverpool and Arsenal in the same week. If they get through those two, they should win the league. And then in the summer, strengthen the squad and build something very special, like you say.
Mm. We're going to move on now to the other games of the weekend. Quickly, 5 minutes. We have had some shouts on Twitter for questions, so we will touch on them as well. West Brom beat Sunderland 2-0. I think they pretty much met expectations with that one, really. Sunderland got beaten by Burnley in the cup in the midweek through a very similar approach, really. Greg Evans on Twitter asked, does anyone have a sweeter left foot in football than Chris Brunt?
No.
It's a ridiculously good strike,
absolutely,
wasn't it?
Unbelievable. That is just, I wouldn't like to be on the receiving end of that that hit.
Such a shame that he didn't make the Euros because of injury as well for Northern Ireland. Mm,
exactly. I mean, Andy Carroll's got another bit of a thumper of a left boot when he connects with those. I just saw that bicycle the other day. But I think Brunt, in terms of sweet, I think that's really sumptuous.
Kind of unexpected, no disrespect to them, but a kind of unexpected source as well. A kind of a left back come left winger playing for Tony Pulis at West Brom. Maybe not expect a bit of culture.
But then if he didn't have that left foot, he wouldn't be playing the Premier League.
Well, absolutely. speaking of a team that might not be playing the Premier League much longer, Crystal Palace were beaten. Palace fans. Beaten 1-0 at home by Everton. The Toffees won the battle of the long ballers, Stobes.
Yeah, I think by all accounts, Everton deserve to win it. Apparently, it was a good performance from Ross Barkley, which is always good to hear because he's so inconsistent. Shame. Another Tom Davis again setting up the goal. Lovely play for Seamus Coleman's goal. Real problems for Palace though. Just can't see where they're going to get.
We said it last week on the pod. Maybe it's as you said actually yourself, I think, George, on the pod last week. He just doesn't have the players of the right kind of profile to what he's used to working with, but just even his usual like mind game tricks just aren't really picking.
Their performances have massively dropped in terms of expected goals since he's come in. Their expected conceded goals has slightly fallen, which is good, but their expected goals scored is almost halved basically per game, which is really concerning. I think it looks like they're going to get Patrick Van Aanholt, which I think would be a great signing at left back for kind of £7 million. If they do that, it'd be a great bit of business. But you just always feel with Allardyce it's going to turn around at some stage, but as Stobe said, it doesn't look good at the moment at all.
It also doesn't look very good for Middlesbrough, who now haven't won in the league since December the 5th. As I said earlier, West Ham are flying up the table now. They're starting to get results. They won 3-1 at the Riverside. Middlesbrough just 4 points off the drop zone. Have we been giving them surprisingly positive press this season, do you think? I know they're recently promoted, but they've been spending a fair bit of money. They've made some signings. I think They've made more signings than they've got points in the league this season. what's going on there?
Well, I think they played well against the big teams, haven't they? They put in a really good shift in the big games, which obviously blinds you a little bit.
They're very cautious though against the mid-table teams.
I think that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's all well and good playing tidy football and playing for a drawing 1-1 with Manchester City, but it's the home games against the likes of West Ham where they'd expect to pick up points. And you know, Adama Traore might look pricey on the counter-attack away at Arsenal in a decent 0-0 draw, but you need him to help you win games when you're playing West Ham at home, and I think that's a problem for them at the moment.
I think that's exactly it. They don't have a match winner, and Traore should definitely be that. I mean, if he's he's worth his salt, then he's got to be putting teams, poorer teams, to the sword with his pace.
One player that is putting poorer teams to the sword, not with his pace, but with his aerial presence and all-round physical ability. Clem McCart off Twitter asks, Andy Carroll. He just asked Andy Carroll, so I've come up with a question for that. Where would West Ham be if he stayed fit? Is he world-class at what he does?
What's that?
What, being Andy Carroll?
Yeah. I mean, he's a great header of the ball. I mean, if you put it in the first goal at the weekend, if you put it in those areas where he can attack it, he's so big, he's so strong, and he's got a leap as well. That's the big thing with Carroll.
Incredibly agile for his size.
He'll get right over a 6'3" or 6'4" defender because he's got such a big leap and absolutely monstrous in the air. The fitness thing is always the problem with Carroll, isn't it?
It's like an XL storage.
Yes.
I mean, I've said this before. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen a striker as good as him in the air. So maybe yes is the answer to the question that you created.
Fair enough.
I certainly think, you know, if Gareth Southgate, you're looking, in terms of a plan B for an England team, even if you think back to Euro 2012 when he came off the, you know, he scored a bullet header as well. Yeah. Like, he's a real option for England.
Well, just think in the icing game, if you can launch up to Carroll, just think, okay, this isn't working, just get Carroll on and just
crosses in. You don't have to launch it from the halfway line. You can get, you know, you've got the fullbacks and the wingers and get crosses in.
What do you think the Iceland centre backs would have thought seeing him coming on? Yeah. I don't think they'd be very happy about it.
Oh, he's going to beat us at our own game. Oh. But, I mean, with Carroll, though, I mean, I always feel a little bit sympathetic to Kenny Dalglish. Because back when Kenny Dalglish, the first time he was a manager, if he would have dropped a load of money on a player like Andy Carroll, he probably would have been worth it. Back when football was a little bit more up and at him, he probably actually would have been absolutely superb.
Well, even if Liverpool had played an old school 4-4-2 like Leicester last season with Carroll and Suarez, something might have worked. It's just the way they were playing, it never suited him, and Suarez just became the main man very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we might go on to Suarez a little bit later when we talk about Europe. But moving on now to another Premier League game, Bournemouth drew 2-2 with Watford. And Mauro Zárate, you might remember him from QPR and West Ham days, is apparently coming in to join Watford, joining Tom Cleverley as the Hornets start to kind of replenish their stocks to an extent. Could we see them doing a run on the top half in the second half of the season, George?
I don't think so, no.
No?
Zárate is just he's one of eight strikers on their books. And Deeney seems to be anyone who ever really plays.
For me, I'm so on Zárate to work. I mean, this is his fourth time in England.
Yeah, it was Birmingham, wasn't it?
He had two spells at West Ham as well. Technically, he's such a wonderful player to watch when he's in form. But
I agree that they've stockpiled talent. Well, is it talent? They stockpiled players. And you know, the way that the thing is, the Pozzo project has worked in the past. And I think that their scouting range and their ability to find play is good. It just seems like at Watford, it's very scattergun. And the players they have don't necessarily play very often. Igalo, it looks like they may be able to cash in for, but, you know.
He hasn't been great, to be fair. So
not at all. If they can, you know, I think they rejected a far bigger offer from the summer than they're going to end up selling him for. But they just haven't really convinced all season, to be honest. And as I said before, Matt Zari came in with this incredible reputation for being able to coax the best out of strikers, and yet we've seen their strikers that are already on their books who were so good last season regress. And I think, to be honest, they're lucky that they've picked up the amount of points that they have, because they are the kind of team that could possibly get sucked into it, but they've probably got enough now, I'd have thought.
Well, one team that also could be sucked into it, Sunday's other game was Southampton 3 Leicester 0. There was lots of talk. I saw some Leicester fans on Twitter actually saying this is one of our worst performances of the last 2 years, and we're getting sucked into the relegation battle. So they're fully aware of it. I mean, just how bad could it get? They are, I think, 5 points above the drop zone. And Carl Anker, again, he sent in many questions. Ranieri went for a kind of tried to match Saints with a midfield diamond. He tried a 3-5-2 against Chelsea as well. Is the Tinker Man now tinkering to destruction, to disaster? What's going on?
Well, he said after the game, just that I'm going back to 4-4-1-1-1. Like, finally, I think that's what they've got to do. I mean, you know, as bad as they've been this season, the AFCON's not helping either this month as well, losing key players. And it's just defensively as well. You know, Wes Morgan, who was an absolute giant of a defender last season, is a complete mess this season. I mean, at fault for a couple of the goals, gave away the penalty, should have scored an own goal.
That's one of the worst performances I've ever seen from centre back Premier League, I think.
I mean, it was absolutely, he's dreadful. And this is the guy who lifted the Premier League trophy last year, and it just shows how far they've fallen and how it's all fallen apart. And you would think towards the end of the season, if they really need to dig something out with the players they've got, with Mahrez, Slimani, Vardy, they'd be able to, but the momentum is certainly slipping away from them.
Players like Mendy just, it hasn't, he doesn't look convincing.
I think they could definitely go down.
Earlier we were talking about how Hall could get back up there. We could talk about how Swansea going to come back up there. Who's going to drop down?
They're playing much better than Leicester, aren't they?
Yeah, much better. Sure. And the thing is, you take away that incredible 3 points they took, and obviously you can't take that away because they deserved it. But you do take that. I mean, that was an anomalous in their season.
Yeah.
So you take that out, and they're right in there. And you've just got to wonder where's the inspiration coming from these players? They've already achieved like way beyond their career achievements and what they did last season, and it must be tough to go down on midday to away at Southampton. You just must think, like, what's the point? I've won the league.
I don't have to do this anymore.
You know, and they're always going to have won the league. You know, if they get, you know, Wes Morgan was absolutely dreadful yesterday, and if they do go down, in 20 years' time, he'll be Premier League winning captain, Wes Morgan. He's not going to be the bloke who took them down as well as captain. So I think they just have to go back to as close as what they were doing last season as possible, and they just need to get Riyad Mahrez back from the AFCON and back in their team as fast as possible.
Even though he's had
a dodgy time, I still just think that Mahrez is the one player who wasn't punched above his weight last season. He is an absolutely top quality player who won't be there, next season. You wouldn't have thought he'll be playing.
Is he kind of doing? I know we said last week that Mesut Ozil isn't doing this, but is he kind of having a bit of a Hazard last year type season? As in, his form just bottomed out.
Possibly. I still think he's had games this season where he's looked their best player still, and so he should. Maybe it's just the hangover from last year or who knows, but I mean, obviously going off to the AFCON, this isn't going to help him kind of reinvigorate himself and his play, but they need him back and firing again, because it could get pretty dire for Ranieri and Leicester quite soon.
It could indeed. We're going to have a quick look around Europe's top flights now, very quickly. The Bundesliga returned, hooray, back in action in Germany. But there were no real shocks, really. Bayern did need something special from Lewandowski, but they beat Freiburg, meeting expectations, really. But it was a fantastic goal from the Polish striker. RB Leipzig won 3-0 versus Frankfurt to keep their chase up, with Dortmund re-entering the top four after beating Werder Bremen 2-1, Thomas Tuchel's side. I mean, they've been hit by injury. They've got a lot of young players. They really need to galvanise themselves and go on a run. But it looks like Champions League football will be returning to Signal Iduna Park. Schalke won as well. So did Hoffenheim as well, who also remain in the European spots. However, Hertha lost to Leverkusen and now drop out of that hallowed Champions League set of qualification places. In La Liga, Sevilla won away to Osasuna in a 3-4 thriller. I mean, we wrote this off as an easy win for them, actually. They had the easiest game of all the title contenders last week, but it turned out to be a bit of a drama. Real and Barca also won, although Busquets was taken off for a really, really nasty-looking injury, which could seriously hamper Barcelona's season. Atletico were held, though, by Athletic Club, with Griezmann scoring the pick of the goals to ensure they got a point in the Basque country. Over in Serie A, Juve put their recent wobble behind them to beat Lazio 2-0 after Napoli got the better of Milan. And Fiorentina won too, after they were obviously the team that shook Allegri's Juventus a little bit with their win on Saturday as well to keep the pressure up. Roma are another side keeping a heat on the champions after they beat a stubborn Cagliari 1-0. And Inter, a bit like Dortmund, are rising up the table and are now in fifth. They're looking like a dangerous dark horse to take the Champions League spots with Milan two spaces behind them. Milan have been kind of the story of the season so far, but it's Inter who are now pushing ahead. So interesting to see what happens there in Italy. And now coming to France in Ligue 1, Nantes' recent run of four straight wins came to an end versus PSG, who are now just a point behind second place Nice, who dropped back from the top of the table after only managing a draw against Bastia. Unfortunately, that was a result that's been overshadowed by a striker Mario Balotelli taking to social media to highlight the racist chants directed at him by sections of the home support in Bastia. The club, I don't know how wise this has been, come out to kind of attack him and his comments as attack against the club, but they have said they're going to cooperate with the French authorities on this one. So probably more on that story to be seen in the days and weeks ahead. Monaco, meanwhile, went top with a 4-0 win over Lorient, while Lyon beat Marseille, with Valbuena celebrating his opening goal by paying tribute to Guido Fofana, who was forced to retire this week from football due to reoccurring injury problems. But quickly, before we move on to your players of the week outside of the Premier League, Monaco, 4-0 win. They're way ahead of everybody else in Europe's top five leagues for goals scored this season, and they're going to be facing Man City in the Champions League in February. I mean, they're a side to watch out for, aren't they, Stobes?
They're probably the best team I've seen this season still, wow. I think. Watch them against Tottenham, and they wipe the floor with Tottenham. Just as Man City did, Monaco did exactly the same, actually, back in December time. And yeah, 23 more goals than the next high scorer in Liga. And just, you know, we mention them every time, Monaco I mentioned, but the two wide men, Thomas Lemar and Bernardo Silva, are just top. They are going to be top quality players if they're not already.
And Jardim as well, he's doing great work as a manager.
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, yeah. Doing so, so well. I keep saying that it can't continue, but it keeps continuing because, you know, as I said, the shot data, it does have them running very hot, but at the same time, they're absolutely flying. And the good thing is there are lots of rumours, especially with Bakayoko, about, you know, players being linked to other clubs in January, but now
that's United fans are now all saying, oh, he's a new Michael Carrick, isn't he? They're all been
that all seems to have died down now, so it looks like they're going to keep hold of their star players. They'll probably be gutted in the summer, but for the meantime, it looks like they can have a massive tilt at both Champions League and Ligue 1 glory.
And they're great to watch as well. I want to know, who have you been your players of the weekend from across Europe's top five leagues?
Mine is Hakan Calhanoglu, who I know you're a huge fan of, Greg.
Oh yeah,
he scored twice in Hertha's defeat. Sorry, Leverkusen's win against Hertha, which is a massive result for them. They've had a really disappointing season. Hertha, on the other hand, they've been absolutely flying. This looked like a real banana skin for them at home as well. Kind of game they couldn't really afford to lose, but looked like they probably would lose. And he stepped up, scoring a penalty and scored an absolutely cracking winner as well. He's a young player and he's a player that I like. I think his set piece delivery is up there with the best in Europe, and he's had a bit of a tough time, so well done him.
Stokes, who was your player of the weekend? I think you might be going for a bit of a mainstream option, but probably a deserved one.
Yeah, I mean, we could do this every week, but Lionel Messi, I think, for me. 4-0 win for Barcelona, incredible goal, ran past four or five players and slotted it in.
I mean, it wasn't a good team performance by Barcelona, but it was the individualism of Messi that kind of saw them through.
And all three of the MSN scored, and you're going to need them, and you're going to need Messi without Busquets. If you think back, Barcelona struggled without Iniesta earlier in the season. So if it looks like Busquets will be out for a while, so they're going to be relying even more heavily on those front three, and particularly Messi.
I mean, is there possibly a chance? I mean, also Denis Suarez scored as well, another Suarez. Is there a chance that this is kind of going to be the start of Messi moving even further backwards? Because there's been talk that he could one day be Xavi's successor. He's been in good form, but he's in and out of shape as well. Busquets going to be out. They're probably going to have to do a huge, massive, big rejig of their midfield. Is Messi going to take more responsibility deeper?
Well, I saw a lot being written about this Messi dropping deeper. And it obviously has this season. You know, it's been a general part of his game.
Some fans even criticise saying he takes away the shape of the team because he's
actually
too free.
But his passing stats are absolutely nowhere near Iniesta's and Xavi. Like, he's obviously getting the ball from further deeper, but he doesn't do the same job as them at all, really. Like, Iniesta will average kind of over, well, somewhere around 100 passes per game. Messi, about half of that yesterday. So I think a little bit too much being made out of it, maybe.
Maybe like comparing Rooney with goals then?
Yeah, that's pretty much perfect.
Fair enough. Well, we're going to look at the week ahead quickly, getting towards the end of the pod now. But obviously AFCON is still taking place this week. It's fair to say it's not been the most spectacular tournament so far. Host Gabon have become the first hosts since Tunisia to fail to reach the knockout stages in the tournament since 1994. And the competition so far has been criticised a bit for its poor quality of play. But surely, if there's one week where it's going to start to really warm up, it's going to be this week. There's some huge matches coming up. Senegal versus Algeria and Zimbabwe versus Tunisia are actually going on tonight, Monday night. We were saying earlier that Senegal are looking at one of the form teams, but Algeria are in a bit of a pickle, really. They haven't had the best results. Well, maybe that could make the match even more interesting because they need to get a win, don't they?
I think that's exactly it. I think Senegal, with their two wins, are safely through and therefore could maybe rest players. You never know, but Algeria obviously need to get a result here. I'm sure there'll be Leicester fans watching, praying they don't. But yeah, it looks like a very good game. I think from what I've seen, Senegal look by far and away the best team in it. They were somewhat lucky to win the first game, but last week they basically swept the floor. So yeah, if anyone hasn't watched it yet, I'd say it'll be a good one to tune into because they're two of the best teams left in it.
Definitely. And later this week as well, Egypt take on Ghana in another heavyweight clash, Stobes. I mean, they're the two of the basically heavyweights of African football. I mean, we've heard that Egypt compared to like the African Germany. But I mean, that's definitely one to tune in for, just surely for the players on display.
Yeah, absolutely. Some familiar names. Mohamed Elneny, Mo Salah as well, who obviously been great in Italy. The RU brothers for Ghana, so it should be a good one to watch.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. The Czech Trade Trophy is also going on this week. George, I know you've got a certain interest in this, given your Oxford affiliations. Yeah. But given all this stuff with the B teams coming in, does anyone really care about this tournament anymore? Has the kind of is its reputation been compromised?
I think due to my B team boycott, I probably shouldn't talk about it. But yeah, well, basically, Oxford got into the final last year, losing to Barnsley, and I went to Wembley. And it was a great day out. We took kind of north of 20,000 fans. This season, in our quarterfinal win last week, it was the lowest ever attendance at the Kasam Stadium.
Wow.
And we're playing Bradford on Tuesday, and I have absolutely no intention of going at all. I'm relieved to say that I'll be out of the country for the finals, which means I don't have to make that decision. But basically, it is completely irrelevant, and I'm sure that it won't be happening next season because it is basically killed what was already a pretty poor competition.
Mm. Speaking of killing things off, Liverpool will be hoping to do that to Southampton in their EFL Cup semi-final second leg, with the Reds needing to win against the Saints, who could be up without Virgil van Dijk after he went off in their 3-0 win at the weekend. And we've already talked about the problem Klopp's side have, but he's been quite critical of Anfield's atmosphere recently again. I mean, they're playing at home. You'd hope the atmosphere would see the players through. But is he playing this card a bit too often, do you think, Stobes?
He was doing it very quickly after he arrived, actually. I think he might have been caught out a little bit. I mean, you know how loud Anfield can be on those big cup nights.
I mean, according to Liverpool fans I know, the atmosphere has improved. So his initial feedback was successful, yeah. I guess, but is he in danger of not becoming a broken record, but it's just becoming a bit repetitive?
I mean, it's okay when Liverpool are doing all right. It's if they go on a bad run and you know, and it comes back to bite you in the backside, really, these comments. I mean, you know, you still hear it at Man United and Chelsea. You know, away fans will go there and they'll sing about what Fergie said about United fans, what Mourinho said about the Chelsea fans, and it's, you know, it's never ideal, because at some point the players are going to have to lift the fans, and I always do think it's up to the players to go first.
That seems almost to be the opposite way around what Klopp's saying, though, because speaking to Liverpool fans both on Twitter and real life, and they're saying that the dip recently has been because the team's dipped, and it's just not quite, they don't feel like they're playing their part to some extent. So yeah, interesting one to see, and with the comments going to bite them back, the whole long ball thing as well, he's got to be careful with these things, because they stuck Matip up front, didn't they, at the weekend, to try and go long. And
I think you just want to take everything a manager says with a pinch of salt. You know, it's not. He's very aware that long ball's a part of football. He doesn't actually think it's just frustration after the United.
It's just weird that they do it, though, because
he's irritable, Klopp. Yeah. Actually, you know, he does get a bit. He does it with a smile, unlike Guardiola or Mourinho. But he gets irritated, and he's a nice guy. But you know, he doesn't really, as we know, he doesn't really hide his emotions very well. So I think that's part of it.
On Van Dijk as well, I just noticed over the weekend that obviously with Font going to West Ham, they've had to announce their new captains, and they announced Stephen Davis as squad captain and Van Dijk as first team captain, which would suggest they maybe are aware that his captaincy might be a short one. Wow. So just something to notice.
Quick word on Font. That's a good signing for West Ham, isn't it?
The time being, yeah. You don't know how long.
For short term, yeah. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't know how long it will go on for.
I think a couple of other clubs decided Font maybe wasn't mobile enough, so it'll be interesting to see how he does at West Ham.
Interesting. Wednesday also sees Leeds United take on Nottingham Forest in the Championship. Different ends of the table at the moment in the second tier, but I guess recent happenings off the pitch with their owners kind of gives them a united front, to some extent, the fans anyway, with both clubs. I mean, Leeds have got this takeover. I think Forest takeover's kind of hit the rocks
again
a bit. Yeah, so
Mr. Fawaz won't be. Yeah, he's not particularly popular still.
We'd like to see both these clubs back in the Premier League soon, won't we?
Definitely. I mean, but with Leeds, it looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel, whereas with Forest, it's pitch dark.
Still looking for the light.
Although they got a good win on the weekend. Leeds went down 3-2 away at Barnsley in a Yorkshire derby, which is obviously a poor result for them. So they'll want to be bounce back. And to be honest, home to Nottingham Forest is probably the game you would choose if you're a team wanting to bounce back at the moment.
Definitely. Thursday night sees Hull City host Manchester United in the EFL Cup semi, their second leg. Surely the 2-0 scoreline, even with Hull's improvements of late under Silva, that United took from Old Trafford, will be enough to see them through.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't see anything but, to be honest. And I think Mourinho will probably play close to his first team against Hull and then rest a few for the FA Cup rather than the other way around as well. So
he does like that competition, doesn't he, the EFL Cup? He likes to get it early. Yeah,
and also if you're trying to change the mentality at a club, you know, United, if there's a bit of a, if they've lost that winning mentality a bit in the last 3 years, I mean, they won the FA Cup, they win this a bit, build a bit of momentum with the trophies, and then next year go for the Premier League. So yeah, I think United will take it serious and I think they'll win it.
And finally, this week also sees Brazil take on Colombia in a friendly put together to actually raise money for the families affected by the Chapecoense crash. And the squads for Brazil made up of players based in Brazil. That's taking place on Wednesday. lovely gesture. Hopefully it raises loads of money for the people affected, and it's a great success for them. But anyway, that has been that we've got. That's all we've got time for today on the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Stoves, thanks for coming on.
Cheers, Greg. Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. George, thanks for coming on as well.
Cheers, Greg.
No problem. Do join us again on Thursday for Nick English, who will be hosting the preview podcast for the weekend. And we've also got another squawker one-to-one between Roy Briggs and John Dillon on Wednesday. So check that out and do join us again soon for more podcasts. Thanks and goodbye for now.